At that time, John said to Jesus, "Teacher, we saw someone driving out demons in your name, and we tried to prevent him because he does not follow us." Jesus replied, "Do not prevent him. There is no one who performs a mighty deed in my name who can at the same time speak ill of me. For whoever is not against us is for us. Anyone who gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ, amen, I say to you, will surely not lose his reward. Whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him if a great millstone were put around his neck and he were thrown into the sea. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life maimed than with two hands to go into Gehenna, into the unquenchable fire. And if your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. It is better for you to enter into life crippled than with two feet to be thrown into Gehenna. And if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Better for you to enter into the kingdom of God with one eye than with two eyes to be thrown into Gehenna, where their worm does not die and the fire is not quenched." The Gospel of the Lord. I have, thanks be to God, been teaching for 10 years, and any teachers that are here will know what I'm about, will understand what I'm about to say. After teaching a subject for long enough, you learn to identify what are the foundations of knowledge of that particular subject. You learn, sometimes through frustrating trial and error, for instance, if people can't understand something, what are they missing from their foundational knowledge of that subject? So, one difficulty that I've come up with against over and over and over again in my years of teaching is I will try to teach my students the foundational, self-evident principle of moral theology, right? So it's the principle that's obvious to everybody who's rational, and it's the foundation on which we build all of our moral reasoning. And that basic principle is this. You should do good and avoid evil. Simple, right? Any rational person who understands the terms good and evil can easily conclude that evil should be avoided and good should be sought. But teenagers are very clever people, and I could probably give you a 2-hour-long lecture just recounting the scenarios that my students have come up with in the last 10 years to test the self-evident principle that you should do good and avoid evil, right? Because another way of saying do good and avoid evil is don't do evil, period. It's not don't do evil except under extenuating circumstances. It's not don't do evil unless there's a really good to be attained. It's simple, do good, avoid evil, don't do evil. So they'll come up with these outlandish, you know, scenarios that very few, if any, people will ever encounter in their lives, where you're presented with a situation. Often it has to do with like the death of many people, right? And the scenario they'll present is, if you do this sinful thing, all these people will be saved. But if you don't do it, all these people will die. What do you do? Right? And I think they pick on this because it's easier to think about sacrificing your own life to truth and goodness than it is to sacrifice others' lives to truth and goodness. So, what is the foundational principle? What's the at the base of knowledge that makes this such a difficult concept to comprehend, that we would even allow others to die rather than do evil? What we have to understand is that there are things that are worse than death, namely sin. I'm going to say that again, and I mean what I say. I'm not misspeaking. Sin is worse than death. It is. Sin is of eternal consequence. Sin is the free distortion of our soul, which lives forever, in favor of some passing good in this world that is always passing away. That's what sin is. And we really don't understand the nature of sin until we step away from simply rule following. Because often we think of sin as, you know, God has arbitrarily, or the church has arbitrarily told us to do certain things or not to do certain things. But that doesn't really encompass the true nature of sin, right? The true nature of sin is when we direct ourselves freely towards an evil, or when we freely deny a good. And the problem with that is that we, all sorts of things can happen to us, right? People can hurt us, they can steal from us, they can torture us, they can imprison us, they can kill us. But all of those are things that are done to us, and because of our belief in the resurrection, we know that those are not the final things. And in fact, no matter what we have to endure in this life, it doesn't even begin to compare, or almost compare, or even imagine comparing to the things that the Lord has in store for us for eternity. All sorts of things can happen to us. But when we do something evil, this is something entirely different. Because we're free, we determine ourselves. We make ourselves to be the kind of people that we are. If I choose to steal, if I choose to kill, if I choose to lie, then I make myself a thief. I make myself a murderer. I make myself a liar. And even if it's because there's some greater good, quote unquote, that I'm seeking, or because there's some extreme pressure on me to commit that evil, it doesn't change the fact that under the pressure of some outside influence, I have directed myself towards an evil and away from a good. And that distorts who I am. That distorts and mars and maybe even destroys the image of God in which I was created. This is the real nature of sin. And this is why the church has so consistently, although we've been less consistent about it lately, to be honest, so consistently over the millennia taught that we love the sinner but hate the sin, that we have an abhorrence towards sin, that we have an intolerance for sin. I tolerate people, fine. Don't tolerate people, love people, but don't tolerate sin. And until we understand that that there are things, that sin is worse than death, that sin is worse than suffering, that sin is worse than deprivation, that sin is even worse than witnessing evils happening to other people, until we understand that, we will never really grasp the moral teachings of the church. And until we understand that, we'll never really grasp a gospel like this, where Jesus tells us, if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. Because it's better to enter into heaven with one eye than with both eyes to be thrown into hell. And if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Because it's better for you to enter into heaven with one hand than with both hands to be cast into the fiery Gehenna. If we don't understand that sin is worse than death or any other evil that can befall us or anyone around us, if we don't have that true hatred and abhorrence and intolerance for sin, first of all in ourselves, and then in our families and in our friends and then in our community, if we don't have that hatred of sin, we will never really understand these seemingly extreme things that Jesus says in the gospel. The question came up in class this last week of, you know, John Paul II said that we live in a culture of death. And it came up because I was talking in my class about what culture is and its relationship to worship, right? The root word of culture is cult. So culture has to do with what we worship, what we fear. And I was trying to explain to my students what John Paul means when he says we have a culture of death. And it's not just the fact that we have abortion and contraception and euthanasia and all that. Those are the clearest, most transparent examples of being a culture of death. I would go further and say that we fear death more than we fear God. Right, if we're willing to do evil to save our lives or the lives of others, then we fear death more than we fear the judgment of God, more than we fear the eternal destiny of our souls, more than we fear goodness. Right? If we are willing to compromise with evil because it's going to cost us money or comfort, then we fear the goods of this world more than we fear God. It's a culture of death. If we will compromise with evil because we don't want to be considered extremists and we don't want people to look weirdly at us or talk about us, then we fear our reputation more than we fear God. It's that simple. So, let's set aside there's a question that I think readily presents itself, which is how literally do I take this gospel passage, right? Am I really supposed to maim myself to avoid sin? Let's just step back from that question and let's take a less extreme application of what Jesus is saying. If my job causes me to sin, am I willing to put my trust in the Lord, set that job behind me, and find a new way to make a living? Surely that's less extreme than plucking out your eye, right? But if your job causes you to sin, are you willing to cut it off? If your computer causes you to sin, are you willing to get rid of it? If your television causes you to sin, are you willing to get rid of it? But Father, that's so extreme. How would I watch the football game, right? I know there's all these temptations that come through it, and I'm weak in the face of those temptations, but come on. If your smartphone causes you to sin, there's GPS, and that's where I got my music on, I do all my Amazon shopping, and you know, I text my kids and all that. Interesting thing, you know, I live in a world of teenagers, right? And I will tell you that teenagers, because they have smartphones, are exposed to all manner of evil. Right? You hand your kid, I'm just going to tell you the truth, and kids, forgive me. You hand your kid a smartphone, I don't care how clever you think you are, they are more clever when it comes to technology. And if they want, they will hide things from you. And you have just handed them unfettered, unobserved access to everything in the world. And you have given, you don't even know who, access to your children, to your phone. I'm telling you this as somebody who spent the last 10 years every single day with high school students. But when I tell that to parents, it falls on deaf ears, right? For all sorts of reasons, right? Well, how am I going to stay in touch with my child if they don't have their phone? I don't know, how did we do it for the last 4,000 years? But we did, right? I'm sorry if this offends, but even more lamely than that, but all their friends have it, and they're going to whine, and they're going to complain, and they're going to hate me. The reason I bring all this up, this homily is not about smartphones. It's simply to point to this tendency in us to bow down before earthly sufferings or even just earthly inconveniences rather than have this real hatred for sin and real desire for goodness, right? Even if we know that something is a grave moral danger in the life of our children, we'll make compromises, right? If your friends cause you to sin, are you willing to cut them off? This one gets really dicey, right? Because then it sort of infringes on the notion of what charity obliges us to. But if I can go back to my days when I was a teenager, there was a really simple but powerful image that my youth minister, I think it was Eric Westby, he gave me this image, and he stood somebody on a chair, and he said, okay, I want you to now, standing on this chair, I want you to pull your friend up onto the chair. And it's very difficult to do, unless your friend is very light and you're very heavy. He says, now, I want your friend to try to pull you down off the chair. And his point was, it's much easier to pull somebody down than it is to pull them up. Now, we do have a responsibility of charity, right? I am not advocating that anybody in your life that's not living the fullness of the faith should be cut off from friendship. But you do have to ask yourself a question. Am I strong enough in this relationship to pull my friend up, or are they pulling me down? through either temptation to a licentious living or to slander and gossip and detraction, all that sort of thing, do I find that rather than drawing my friend deeper into relationship with the Lord and towards holiness, are they pulling me away from the Lord? And if that's the case, if my friend is causing me to sin, am I willing to cut them out? Because the truth is, it's better to go to heaven with no friends than to be the most popular kid in the school and be cast into Gehenna. So, brothers and sisters, the painful teaching, it's not easy, but it is very clear. Jesus tells us that we have to have an intolerance for sin, and we have to have a real desire for holiness in our lives. And what's more, it's not enough for me to simply say, I don't want to be a sinner anymore. I have to be willing to make the changes in my life that I need to make so that I can cut sin out of it.